Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thanksgiving Day, Thursday, November 25th, 2021. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. Thursday's weather in the Dubuque area will be turning sunny, breezy, and much colder, with a high of 32 and a low of 14. The lead story on the front page of Thursday's Telegraph Herald is written by Benjamin Fisher and titled, Virus Cases Mounting. As people gather indoors for the holidays, health leaders urge residents not to let their guard down. The number of new COVID-19 cases in Dubuque County climbed Wednesday for the fifth straight week, prompting public health officials to encourage residents to exercise caution as they celebrate the holiday. Another 691 county residents were confirmed to have the coronavirus from November 17th to Wednesday. That equates to an average of about 99 new cases per day, a level of local spread not seen since last November. One local COVID-19-related death also was reported in the county over the past week. The rise in new cases continues to trouble area health professionals on the Dubuque County COVID-19 Incident Management Team. Quote, with the holidays, people now are starting to really suffer from pandemic exhaustion, said County Health Department Director Patrice Lambert. They're wanting to return much sooner to a so-called normal life and are letting their guard down by not following the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's and County Board of Health's advice. Now we're starting to move everything back inside. End quote. And based on new positive cases, Dubuque County had a worse week preceding Thanksgiving this year than in 2020. In the 7 days before Thanksgiving of last year, there were 629 new cases. The surrounding area also saw a significant increase in the past week. In Iowa, Jackson County had 124 new cases during the week ending Wednesday, compared to 73 in the prior week. Delaware County had 106, compared to 76 1 week earlier. Jones County had 95, compared to 92, and Clayton County had 79, compared to 56. In Wisconsin, Grant County had 162 new cases during the week ending Wednesday, compared to 96 in the prior week. Crawford County's count nearly doubled to 69, compared to 35 1 week earlier. Iowa County's count rose from 43 new cases to 65, and Lafayette County's climbed from 41 to 61. In Joe Davies County, Illinois, there were 107 new cases in the recent week, compared to 96 1 week earlier. While the local upswing in new cases ahead of Thanksgiving is similar to last year, there is one big difference, the availability of COVID-19 vaccinations. As of Wednesday, about 70% of Dubuque County residents, 12 and older, were fully vaccinated. Children younger than 5 are not eligible to be vaccinated, and vaccinations were so recently approved for children 5 to 11 that none of them are fully vaccinated yet. Lambert said Dubuque County's vaccination rate makes heading into the holidays somewhat safer. Quote, that still doesn't give us the green light to just ignore all the public health advice, she said. Vaccines have that potential to wane, end quote. The Iowa Department of Public Health does not report how many COVID-19 cases are in those previously vaccinated, but it continues to release data that shows that vaccinated people, if they contract COVID-19, are far less likely to end up in the hospital. As of Wednesday, 75% of people with COVID-19 who were hospitalized statewide were not fully vaccinated. The total climbs to 86% when talking about COVID-19 patients in ICUs. Statewide, 623 COVID-19 patients were hospitalized as of Wednesday, with 146 in ICU. The IDPH no longer reports hospitalizations due to COVID-19 by county. But Wednesday marked the third week in which Dubuque's two hospitals have shared COVID-19 patient figures with the Telegraph Herald. Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center and Unity Point Health Finley Hospital on Wednesday reported a total of 41 such patients, compared to 35 last week and 31 the week before. At an event this week, Regional Medical Center CEO Danette Kramer told a group of Delaware County business, government, and education leaders that the Manchester Hospital's capacity was increasingly stressed. quote, "We are seeing volumes in our ER and our ambulances that are 20-year highs," she said. "We're making, on average, 20 calls when we have to transport someone out. Our inpatient rooms have been single occupancy. That's the way they were designed. But we have had to put a second bed in some," end quote. To avoid increasing strain on the area's healthcare system, Lambert asked residents to take extra care in celebrating the holidays this year. Quote, "All adults have the eligibility to go in for the booster," she said. "But if your family hasn't had your boosters yet, move some of your activities outside. Get out the football and throw it in the yard, and in the morning do a quick self-assessment. Do you feel at all ill? If so, don't go out," end quote. In news from Dubuque and the tri-state region, Kaylee Reese of the Telegraph Herald writes, "Steeple Square's incredible journey completed. The final phase of the renovation project at the former St. Mary's Catholic Parish property is done. An open house is set for Tuesday. The final phase of the Steeple Square project in Dubuque has been completed, and officials look forward to using the renovated space to serve the community. The lower level of the former St. Mary's Catholic Parish property at the corner of White and East 15th Streets now is home to a new multi-use community center and culinary kitchen. While the new spaces have been open for use for about a month, the official open house and ribbon-cutting for the project will take place at 4:30 p.m. Tuesday, November 30th. Quote, "This expansion is the last leg of a pretty incredible journey for Steeple Square," said John Schmidt, Steeple Square board president. "And now we will fulfill our outreach that we've really been focused on as we transition from rebuilding buildings to rebuilding the community," end quote. The final phase of the Steeple Square project began this spring, according to Judy Wolf, board treasurer and president of the Marita Thyssen Child Care Center. "The lower-level project cost about $1.2 million," Wolf said, "but it was part of an ongoing $15 million project funded through a combination of grants, donations, and state and historic tax credits. The first phase of the project, creating 12 affordable housing units, was completed in 2017, followed in 2018 by the refurbishing of the steeple. The child care center opened in 2019. This past year, the Steeple Square Community Event Center and Honecamp Hall also opened on the floor above the newly completed center and culinary kitchen. Through a partnership with Northeast Iowa Community College and Four Mounds, Wolf said the kitchen is being used for culinary arts classes. Students register for the classes through NICC but don't have to be current students, she said. Participants in the program have the opportunity to receive free tuition and free child care at the Marita Thyssen Center when classes are occurring, Wolf said. Quote, "The idea is to remove the barriers of transportation and access to education and to be able to provide that in a secure setting," she said. Wolf also noted that the culinary kitchen is named for Sister Helen Hugh, a founding Steeple Square board member and community leader who died last year. Quote, "She was involved from the outset for the vision of transforming St. Mary's into its current state," Wolf said. "Really, part of her personal vision was to be able to provide a culinary space," end quote. The multi-use Sisters of Charity BVM Community Center is now open on the lower floor of the property. Wolf said the center can be rented for events, but it also will be the site of future vocational training on the property. In addition to the culinary kitchen, individuals can earn a child care certificate at Steeple Square property. Future certificate programs being considered include hospitality, customer service, and carpentry, Wolf said. Quote, "We have the opportunity to utilize our resources to serve a core group of people who need help kickstarting or advancing their career," she said. In another article from the Tri-State region, Elizabeth Kelsey writes, "Area organizations seek donations amid ongoing blood shortage." Amid an ongoing blood shortage, local organizations urge area residents to take time out of their holiday schedules to donate. Quote, "This is such a wonderful season where folks want to do good, and they want to share the joy and thankfulness of the season," said American Red Cross spokesperson Emily Hawley. Quote, "We say that one of the best ways to do that is to come in and give blood," end quote. The Red Cross, which will hold a blood drive this Friday at Kennedy Mall in Dubuque, faces an emergency blood and platelet shortage. The current blood supply is the lowest the organization has seen at this time of year in more than a decade, according to a press release. The shortage has been ongoing for several months and is particularly concerning as temperatures drop, Holly said. Quote, as we're getting into the winter, there are unfortunately more car accidents due to bad weather and high traffic volume, she said. In those trauma situations, we want to make sure that hospitals have the blood they need, end quote. Donations also have been sought at Impact Life, which operates blood distribution hubs and donor centers across Iowa, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Missouri. Jason Schomburg, associate donor relations consultant with Impact Life in Dubuque, said the organization's blood supplies still have not fully returned to pre-pandemic levels. Furthermore, Impact Life regularly sees a dip in donations around the holidays. Impact Life seeks to collect about 3,600 blood donations each week across its four-state region, but this week the organization projects an estimate of only 2,600. Kirby Wynn, public relations manager for Impact Life, said while much of the country takes the day off today, the use of blood for patient care continues. Quote, we don't collect blood on Thanksgiving, but blood is used continually, he said. Schomburg said the organization is currently in, quote, critical need, end quote, of types O positive, O negative, B negative, and AB negative blood. However, regardless of blood type, all eligible donors should consider making an appointment this holiday season. Quote, you're not just giving blood, you're giving someone another Christmas, he said, adding, quote, you're giving somebody more time with family, end quote. Ali Hinga of the Telegraph Herald writes, young mother thankful for help. 22-year-old Morgan Miller of Dubuque reflects on her long road to recovery and finding purpose in her role as a mother of three. On a recent afternoon, Morgan Miller dressed her children and changed their diapers in her Dubuque home. Her daughter Rosalyn, age 2, spun in circles in the living room, fell, laughed, and got back up. Miller slipped her son Luxinder, aged 1, into jeans and a long-sleeved shirt, explaining that her middle child is more of an observer and is starting to talk. Rosalyn planted a kiss on Miller's youngest child, Griffin, who is 4 months old. Quote, what a nice big sister, crooned Miller, age 22. It was a scene that at one point might not have seemed possible for Miller, who about a year and a half ago arrived at Dubuque's Teresa Shelter, homeless, battling drug addiction, and desperate to keep custody of her then only child. Since then, though, Miller has stayed clean, gotten married, moved out of the shelter, and is caring for her three children. Now she feels she has what she needs to navigate life as she looks forward to what's next. Quote, I have the tools to do it now, she said. Before, I was just kind of sinking. Now I can swim. End quote. A long road. Miller's road to getting back on her feet has been a long one. She grew up in Arizona with an alcoholic mother who lost custody of Miller and her sister when Miller was 13. At age 15, Miller started using drugs. She moved to Dubuque in 2018 and got sober for several months, but eventually relapsed and was using heroin and methamphetamine. Miller got clean after finding out she was pregnant with Rosalyn, but after her birth, she found herself in a toxic relationship and started using again. Quote, when you have a kid, being addicted to drugs is definitely not what you want to be, Miller said. It just makes you feel like the worst of the worst people. That's not something you want to teach them. That's not something you want to make a frequent thing in your life. It really tears you down, and I just didn't want to, but I couldn't stop either. End quote. Eventually, Miller's boyfriend was arrested on drug charges, and Miller was at risk of losing custody of Rosalyn. She reached her lowest point yet. Quote, I knew that they wouldn't let me keep Rosalyn, she said. I didn't have help. I didn't have backup. I didn't have any support. That weekend was definitely the worst weekend of my life. End quote. Miller knew something had to change. In March of 2020, she moved into Teresa Shelter, a Service of Dubuque nonprofit opening doors. Quote, I just can't imagine my life without my kids, so I did what needed to be done, Miller said. Finding consistency. In the beginning, staying at the shelter was hard for Miller. She was just 12 days sober, full of resentment, and thought she only was there to keep custody of her daughter. But once she started opening up to workers at the shelter, her life started to change. The shelter became a home for her. Quote, "It was consistency, and I wasn't used to that, and I fell in love with that," Miller said. Miller started and eventually graduated from substance abuse treatment. She started attending Narcotics Anonymous, a trauma group, and other programs at the shelter. She found activities she enjoyed and realized she could enjoy life without drugs. Miller also found work, gave birth to Luxander, saved up money, and started taking classes at Northeast Iowa Community College. When she struggled, the staff at the shelter was there to support her. Quote, "I was given a lot of praise and was given a lot of encouragement because once we got going, I did not stop," Miller said. In May of 2021, Miller left Teresa Shelter and moved into a home in Dubuque with her children. Heather LuGrane, program director for Opening Doors, said Miller needed a lot of support when she arrived at the shelter, but she also knew how to communicate her needs and wanted to better herself. Quote, "It wasn't just, oh, I have to be here. But she wanted to do better, and she was willing to do anything she had to do better," LuGrane said. LuGrane said that in her 11 years with Opening Doors, Miller has been one of the most successful clients she has seen. Quote, "I truly believe from when she got in here to when she left is a complete 360," LuGrane said. "I would say the biggest and best thing that she accomplished was learning how to love herself for the first time in her entire life, and being able to feel vulnerable enough to work through that process, and she was able to do that," end quote. Making progress. On a recent afternoon, Miller sat on the porch of her Jackson Street home, smoking a cigarette. Thanksgiving was just days away, her first since leaving Teresa Shelter, and she noted that she and her husband were planning to host her husband's family for a meal. Quote, "I never thought I would say it. Thanksgiving at my house," Miller said. She admits that leaving the shelter was hard at first. She would call staff there 3 or 4 times a day, and they would reassure her she could make it. Eventually, though, being on her own started to come more naturally. She holds a job as a housekeeper and cares for her 3 children. In May, she married Nicholas Mayers, and she gave birth to their youngest son in July. Miller still regularly keeps in touch with Opening Doors staff, stopping by Teresa Shelter if she needs diapers or food, and she remains connected with her caseworker there. She considers the people there family. Quote, "I've met so many wonderful people through this program," she said. "It really gives you a sense of community. They say it takes a village to raise kids, and I have my village, and that's through this community," end quote. LuGrane said Miller has been successful at caring for herself and her children and is living a life that she always wanted. Quote, "There's still room to grow, but she's living that life, and she wasn't sure if she was ever going to be able to get there at one point," LuGrane said. In today's installment of Throwback Thursday, Eric Hogstrom writes, 1976, so-called pilgrims take part in church service. One of Dubuque's oldest churches celebrated Thanksgiving in a unique way 45 years ago. Parishioners of Dubuque's First Congregational Church dressed as pilgrims during a Thanksgiving service in November 1976. Congregational churches founded by the pilgrims and other spiritual reformers in the 1600s spread rapidly through New England and then westward. The Reverend James A. Clark, hired by the Congregational Home Mission Society, organized the first Congregational Church in 1839 for Dubuque settlers. The cornerstone for the present church on 10th Street was laid in 1856, and the church was dedicated in 1860. Here is how the Telegraph Herald reported on the special service in its November 24, 1976 edition. Thanksgiving, 1620 style. Church celebrates heritage in so-called pilgrim service. Parishioners dressed like pilgrims for the Thanksgiving service at Dubuque's First Congregational Church. Men with blunderbusses stood sentry outside the church on 10th Street, and inside, men, women, and children wore clothing reminiscent of the pilgrims' attire in 1620. The Reverend Elmer Baker, the church's pastor, said about 40 members of the congregation, including the choir, dressed like Plymouth Colony settlers for the second annual pilgrim-style Thanksgiving service. Quote, "We are celebrating our heritage, our congregational church heritage, which extends to the Pilgrims, Baker said. Dubuque's First Congregational Church, which was formed in 1839, is a direct descendant of the church founded by the Pilgrims, Baker said. The austere customs of the Pilgrims, who were among the first to allow to follow the Protestant ethic, weren't apparent at the Dubuque church service. But an old pair of cloth pouches on sticks, once used to collect the offering, were put into use again, and the Reverend Hattie Duncan read the congregation a portion of the first Thanksgiving proclamation made by George Washington in 1789. And this article is accompanied by a photograph of members of the First Congregational Church in Dubuque dressed as Plymouth Colony settlers during a so-called pilgrim-style Thanksgiving Day service on November 24, 1976, at the church. Let's turn now to the opinion page of Thursday's Telegraph Herald. It includes an Other View column written by Arthur Sear for the Telegraph Herald, titled, Thanksgiving Illustrates Lincoln's Legacy. The editor's note reads, this commentary is reprinted and adapted from the author's previous columns on the events. Thanksgiving means actual, not contrived, inclusiveness. President Abraham Lincoln profoundly demonstrates this fundamental point. On October 3, 1863, the White House issued the Thanksgiving Proclamation, declaring the last Thursday of November to be, quote, a day of thanksgiving and praise to our beneficent Father who dwelleth in the heavens, end quote. The proclamation also requested, quote, the interposition of the Almighty Hand to heal the wounds of the nation and to restore peace, harmony, and union, end quote. Earlier, Lincoln had ordered government offices closed on November 28, 1861, for a day of thanksgiving. Up until the 1863 proclamation, individual states had celebrated days of giving thanks. Sarah Joseph Hale, editor of the influential Godey's Ladies book, had written to Lincoln in late September of that year pressing for a national day of thanks, a goal she pursued for many years without success. According to Lincoln's administrative aide, John Nicolay, Secretary of State William H. Seward signed the document. Lincoln and Seward by then were friends as well as allies. Unity was an overarching Lincoln theme throughout the Civil War, employed with shrewd calculation and brilliant political timing. By the fall of 1863, the strategic position of the Union had taken a welcome turn for the better. In July, there were two significant victories, the Battle of Gettysburg in Pennsylvania and the capture of Vicksburg, Mississippi. A sizable Confederate army never again would invade the North, and the Great Mississippi River was now completely in Union control. During the preceding year, one military development provided Lincoln precious political opportunity. On September 17, 1862, the Army of the Potomac, under General George B. McClellan, defeated General Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia at Antietam Creek in Maryland. The victory was technical. Lee withdrew in order but left the Union forces in control. Nevertheless, the outcome qualified as a Union military success, desperately welcome. Lincoln faced extremely serious challenges beyond the Confederacy. General McClellan was popular with rank-and-file soldiers. He also nurtured national political ambitions. He was committed to the Union but strongly opposed abolition of slavery. A talented organizer and administrator, he refused to be aggressive in attacking Lee's army. McClellan became insubordinate, demanding control over all war policy. Lincoln then fired him. McClellan became the Democratic Party's 1864 presidential nominee. Lincoln defeated him again. President Lincoln, finally confirming control of the army, moved quickly to exploit the Antietam victory by issuing the Emancipation Proclamation. The executive order of January 1, 1863, freed slaves in the Confederate States. From the fall of 1862, the U.S. government issued a series of warnings under the Second Confiscation Act, passed by Congress on July 17, 1862. The legislation confirmed in law Lincoln's war powers. Critics have argued Lincoln should have included states in the Union, but that would have been unlawful and unwise. Slavery was still legal under the Constitution, and ended in law only when a sufficient number of states ratified the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, announced December 18, 1865. Slavery had support in border states and areas of the North. By design, the Emancipation Proclamation is a detailed, dry document that makes the case for removing property with emphasis on procedure. There is no reference to fundamental moral concerns expressed elsewhere, especially in Lincoln's Gettysburg Address and Second Inaugural. Civil War goals changed from only restoring the Union to abolition of slavery. Abraham Lincoln used practical means for transcended goals with astonishing political skill. Again, this is the opinion of Arthur Sear, published in Thursday's Telegraph Herald opinion page. The opinion page also includes an editorial cartoon drawn by Jeff Koterba. It depicts a family gathered around a Thanksgiving dinner, hands folded in prayer, napkins still folded on plates, and the young child offering the prayer says, "We give thanks in advance for no political talk on this day." Today's opinion page also includes an Other View column by Kathy Obradovich of the Iowa Capital Dispatch, titled, "Dispute Over Reynolds' Use of COVID Cash Highlights Budget Shell Game." Republicans work hard to sell the idea their party is the one that stands for fiscal responsibility. They are leaning heavily on that message on the federal level as Democrats approach a vote on the second of two multi-trillion-dollar spending bills. Here in Iowa, Republicans in the legislature have for decades espoused the principle of not spending so-called one-time money for ongoing expenses. So, for example, if the state received a three-year federal grant for public safety, GOP lawmakers likely would resist using the money to hire more state troopers who will still have to be paid after the federal cash is gone. Like much political rhetoric, this makes sense if you don't look too closely. Governor Kim Reynolds isn't letting any pesky principles slow her down, however, as she tosses around federal coronavirus cash like a jackpot winner in a casino ad. Last week, a state audit reported she improperly spent almost $450,000 of federal COVID-19 aid on employee salaries. Salaries, obviously, are an ongoing expense. The audit report says 20 of the 21 employees involved were employees of the governor's office before the pandemic, and each employee was paid only their regular salary. So these weren't temp workers or hourly employees getting overtime. Quote, "What is not clear is why these salaries were not included in the governor's budget set prior to the fiscal year and prior to the pandemic. Based on this information, we conclude that the budget shortfall was not a result of the pandemic," the audit report states. Why weren't those salaries in the governor's budget? Well, that's a complicated question. The legislature hasn't seen fit to include line items for most executive branch salary increases in the state budget for more than two decades. Parenthetical comment, Democrats in the legislature and Governor Chet Culver stopped approving a separate salary bill in 2009 during the national recession. Republicans have continued the practice since they took over the House majority in 2011. Close paren. Instead, lawmakers approve a lump sum for state agencies that may or may not cover negotiated pay raises. Department managers have the authority to allocate the money as they see fit. That often means open positions are left dark or other costs are cut to cover salary increases, all without any public accountability. Adding to the lack of transparency on salaries, the governor's office routinely, quote, borrows, end quotes, employees who are paid by other executive branch agencies. That allows the governor to bulk up her own staff without the political cost of asking lawmakers for more money. This audit report makes that salary shell game a big liability. It alleges the governor's office employed more people than its budget could support and used the federal money to plug the hole. The governor's office argues the staff were spending most of their time on COVID-19 mitigation efforts, a, quote, allowable expense, end quote, and the only issue in dispute is documentation of that time. If the governor's office can't come up with contemporary documents, the audit recommends reimbursing the state's coronavirus relief fund so the feds don't claw the money back. The auditor's report says the governor's office has failed to produce any documentation despite being asked for it twice. State Auditor Rob Sand warned the governor's office over a year ago that he was questioning the use of federal virus money for state salaries. There's a political undertone to this dispute. Reynolds, a Republican, is seeking re-election. Sand, a Democrat, has been considered a potential rival for the job, although he has not announced any 2022 plans so far. In the meantime, however, Sand is doing what GOP lawmakers refuse to do: make sure there's some accountability for how the governor is spending nearly $1.5 billion in federal cash. Reynolds already had to return $21 million to the state coronavirus relief fund that Sand and the U.S. Treasury Department said she misspent on a software project that had been planned prior to the pandemic. The legislature, which had previously refused to appropriate money for the project, ended up paying the tab. Sand hasn't always hit the mark with his review of the governor's federal COVID-19 spending. In June, his office accused Reynolds of illegally using about $152,000 of federal COVID aid to promote herself through a public service media campaign. "I thought this was a stretch, and so did the Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board, which found no violation of state ethics rules." Even so, the Republican majority in the legislature should recognize this latest conflict as a sign they should reform budgeting practices for state salaries. They should pass annual salary bills or require line items in department budgets for employee raises. They should forbid agencies from paying salaries for people who work in a different department. By approving lump sum budgets for the executive branch, they should recognize they're squandering their power over the purse strings and abdicating their responsibility. They should, but they won't. They should, but they won't, scrutinize and hold the governor accountable for every dime of federal COVID-19 relief money that is pouring through her hands. They had the opportunity to do that this year and decided instead to leave all the federal aid out of the state budget, with the governor in charge of allocating the money. Iowans should demand actual fiscal responsibility from the party that claims to own that title. They should, but they probably won't. Again, this is the opinion of Kathy Obradovich, who has been covering Iowa government and politics for more than 30 years, most recently as political columnist and opinion editor for the Des Moines Register. She previously covered the Iowa State House for 10 years for newspapers in Davenport, Waterloo, Sioux City, Mason City, and Muscatine. You're listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thanksgiving Day, Thursday, November 25th, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Mary E. Tuyich, aged 100, of Guttenberg, Iowa, passed away on November 21st at Guttenberg Care Center with family beside her. Mary was born on October 29, 1921, on a dairy farm in Farley, Iowa, to Frank and Mary Jarina Zalaznik. She attended St. Joseph's Elementary and High School, graduating in 1939. Mary loved growing up on the farm and helped out with milking, occasionally driving a tractor, and mowing the huge lawn with a hand-powered mower. In 1940, she met her future husband, Gene Tuyich, at a dance in Dyersville. They dated for 5 years, much of the time by letter when Gene was overseas in World War II. They married on May 21, 1946, at St. Joseph's Church in Farley. Mary worked at the family business, Tuyich Grocery, for 20 years with her husband Gene and father-in-law Lentz. Later, when Gene became postmaster of Guttenberg, Mary supported him by attending postal meetings and NAPUS events. Mary loved decorating, baking, cooking, and hosting dinners for family and friends. She was an excellent seamstress. Mary and Jean also loved dancing to big bands at Lakeside Ballroom in Guttenberg and Melody Mill in Dubuque. She loved reading, but when she lost most of her sight, Mary listened to at least 2 books on tape per week. She faced any setbacks with grace and courage. She loved being a wife and mother. Her strong faith was always present in her life. Arrangements are being handled by Tuke Allen Funeral Home, 207 South 1st Street in Guttenberg. The family will receive friends from 9:30 a.m. to 11 a.m. Friday, November 26th, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Guttenberg. Funeral service will be at St. Mary's Catholic Church at 11 a.m. on Friday, November 26th, with the Reverend Marvin Breeze officiating. Interment will be at Mount Olivet Catholic Cemetery in Guttenberg. Dwayne Robert Weenan, aged 69, of Galena, passed away Monday, November 22nd, at Mercy One in Dubuque. A funeral service will be held at 11:30 a.m. Saturday, November 27th, at the Furlong Funeral Chapel in Galena, where friends may call after 9:30 a.m. until the time of service. The burial will be held in Greenwood Cemetery in Galena. Duane was born August 26, 1951, in Hazel Green, Wisconsin, the son of Glenn and Jen Spruill Weenan. Duane graduated from Galena High School with the class of 1970. He was united in marriage to Deborah K. Brotzman on July 3, 1971, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Galena. She preceded him in death on September 10, 2009. Duane worked as a farmer most of his life until selling. He then began working at the Cuba City feed mill until ending his working career with his son in the concrete business. Duane enjoyed hunting, gator riding, and hanging out at his lodge with his family and friends, enjoying a cold beer. He loved having his granddaughters beside him. Online condolences may be left for Duane's family at the website furlongfuneralchapel.com. Ada Marie Lynch, aged 19 months, passed away peacefully wrapped in her mother's arms and her father by her side on Thursday, November 11th. She was born on March 30th, 2020, in Denver, Colorado, to Patrick and Megan Wolf Lynch. Early in life, Ada was diagnosed with a rare brain illness. Despite this, she blew through all expectations and lived a beautiful life. Ada spent her life surrounded by people who loved and adored her, earning her the nickname Ada Sweet Potato. She enjoyed hiking and shopping with her mama and listening to her silly songs. When she snuggled with her daddy, she loved to touch his whiskers and give high fives. She had a special bond with her siblings, Daniel and Nora. She loved to pull their hair, and they encouraged it, seeing how happy it made her. Ada is survived by her parents, Patrick and Megan, her brother Daniel, her sister Nora, grandparents Mark and Lynn Wolf, Tim and Sherry Lynch, and great-grandparents Lucille Schmidt and Carol Lynch, as well as uncles and aunts Marcus and Talia Lynch, Danielle Lynch, and Jenna and Chris Henshaw. Ada's family will be holding a celebration of life service at Three Trees Chapel in Littleton, Colorado, on Wednesday, December 1st at 11:30 a.m. Diane K. Bonjour, age 68, of Dubuque, died Monday, November 22nd. Visitation will be held from 2 to 4 p.m. Saturday, November 27th, at Miller Funeral Home in East Dubuque, Illinois. Complete arrangements are pending. Funeral service notices, published in Thursday's Telegraph Herald, include those for Karen M. Atkins of Piasta. Visitation will be 3 to 7 p.m. Friday, November 26th, at Hoffman Schneider & Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory on Asbury Road. Service will be 10 a.m. Saturday, November 27th, at the funeral home. Arrangements for Thomas C. Burbach of Dubuque include a celebration of life at 4 p.m. Saturday, November 27th, at Sunset Hall in Dickeyville, Wisconsin. Arrangements for Shirley M. Cocaine of Dubuque include visitation from 2 to 6 p.m. Friday, November 26th, at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory on Rockdale Road, and 9 to 10:30 a.m. Saturday, November 27th at St. John's Lutheran Church, where service will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday. Arrangements for Boomer J. Gatina of Dubuque include Mass of Christian Burial at 10 a.m. Saturday, November 27th at Sacred Heart Catholic Church. Arrangements for Mary E. Harold of Dubuque include visitation from 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday, November 27th at Egelhoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home on John F. Kennedy Road, with service at 11:30 a.m. Saturday at the funeral home. That concludes the obituaries in Thursday's Telegraph Herald. Let's turn now to the sports section of Thursday's Telegraph Herald. The lead story is an article by Tim O'Neill, featuring the 2021 Telegraph Herald All-Area Football Team Player of the Year, Bo Kopp of Cuba City. O'Neill's article is titled, Extra Work Pays Dividends. Kopp raises the standard for Cuba City football. As long as he can remember, football has been a part of Bo Kopp's life. The son of a high school football coach, Kopp has been tagging along to practices for most of the past 16 years. His football journey is far from over, but his path came full circle this year, completing his third and final season coached by his father as the starting quarterback at Cuba City High School. Quote, "When I was younger, around all these big kids, I was always thinking they were ginormous," Kopp said. "Now this year as a senior, I'm looking down at the water boys and thinking, wow, do they think I'm humongous like I did when I was little? I remember going to practice and skipping daycare just to be at practice with my dad. Just every day out painting the fields, getting the pads ready for the players. I loved being the water boy, and then just to play for my dad, it's amazing." End quote. Kopp, the TH Football Player of the Year, was pretty amazing himself on the field. He broke the program's career passing yards record and led the Cubans into the third round of the WIAA Division VI playoffs, a specific point of pride for Kopp despite being dissatisfied with the result. Cuba City coach Guy Kopp had never previously reached the third round of the postseason, Bo said. Quote, "That was one of my goals, to be the best team my dad's ever had, which was pretty cool for me," he said. It was pretty cool for Dad, too. Quote, "Everything you dream of," Guy Kopp said. "You bring him to practice, you bring him to film session, you bring him to meetings at a young age. You just hope that he will excel." End quote. Bo Kopp was on the varsity roster for four seasons, but started just the final three. In addition to all of his pre-high school football education, he also benefited from the tutelage of former starter Andy Clendenin. He spent that first season on the sideline, watching Clendenin and charting plays as he stood next to offensive coordinator Steve Graber. It manifested itself in a senior season in which Kopp was named first team All-Swall on offense, defense, and special teams, and earned Wisconsin Football Coaches Association All-State honorable mention as both a quarterback and a punter. He was the Swall's Offensive Player of the Year after throwing for 2,143 yards with 24 touchdowns. He also ran for 416 yards and 12 more scores, but perhaps his most impressive statistical line comes on the other side of the ball. Kopp had 55 solo tackles, 19 tackles for loss, and an astounding 14 sacks as a defensive end, a number that is impressive for any player, but especially a quarterback. Quote, "Extreme work ethic in the weight room," Guy Kopp explained. "As a freshman, he was undersized. He understood the game, but he knew he had to put in extra work to be able to compete at the high level that he competed for us for the past 3 years." End quote. Then, at the tail end of his sophomore year of high school, the whole world changed. The COVID-19 pandemic forced the cancellation of his track season. The fall football season was delayed until spring. Bo decided to take action, thanks to one of the lessons he learned tagging along to practice as a youngster. Quote, "A great team is run by a great leader, and that's one of the roles I stepped into senior year. I wanted to lead our team," he said. "In the past, as a water boy, I'd seen years go by where there wasn't that senior leadership, and the outcome of the season wasn't very good. So I knew coming in, I got the seniors, and I was like, we've got to be leaders this year. We've got to run this team so we can accomplish what we want." End quote. That meant more time in the weight room. It also meant taking advantage of the opportunity to get out and run drills with teammates during a period in which coaches couldn't. That led to open fields and pickup games on a near-daily basis. Players ran drills and helped develop their footwork for a season that was still a winter away. Cuba City went 4-2 during the abbreviated spring. After a two-month break, Bo led the Cubans to a 9-3 record and a Swall runner-up finish to Darlington, the state semifinalist that ended the Cubans' season in the quarterfinals. He also turned down a potential captain's spot as a junior, giving it to a graduating senior instead. Quote, "I just felt like the seniors deserved to be captains. I didn't want to take that away from them," he said. "With COVID and everything, I wasn't going to take a captain's spot away from anyone." End quote. Guy will get another chance to coach his son. Bo is a returning state track qualifier who competes in short shot put, discus, and the 4x100 relay. But when Bo is going off playing college football next year, he's still undecided where, but will pursue it as his number one passion. Quarterback is going to be a tough position for the Cubans to fill. Quote, "I told my wife,
I said, the first time in 30 years I'm cleaning out my office on a Sunday, he said. I never clean my office out on a Sunday after we lost. She goes, what were you doing? I said, I was doing a lot of crying. End quote. Other TH All-Area Football Team honorees include Mark Atwater, Coach of the Year at Dyersville Beckman. 2021 record for their team was 11-1. First team offense includes Jack Gilligan of Dubuque Senior, who plays quarterback, Jack Clemens of Western Dubuque, also a quarterback, Owen Hewengarth of Dyersville Beckman, a running back, Jack Menster of Cascade, a running back, Spencer Zinn of Western Dubuque, also a running back. First team offense also includes Jaden Siegert of Dubuque Hempstead, Hayden Francois of Dubuque Senior, Andrew Oltmans of Western Dubuque, Jesse Martin of Platteville, Evan Surface of Western Dubuque, Max McGuire of Darlington, Bo Hansen of Mineral Point, John Ostrander of Dubuque Hempstead, and Brett Burlodge of Dyersville Beckman. First team defense includes Devin Digman of Platteville, Ben Werner of Benton Scales Mound Shulsburg, David Knees of River Ridge, Wisconsin, Jason Koopman of Dyersville Beckman, Logan Drone of River Ridge, Wyatt Volker of West Delaware, Elliot Naughton of Dyersville Beckman, Brady Horn of Darlington, Lucas Sakudakis of Dubuque Hempstead, Owen Vogelsberg of Potosi Cassville, Luke Odafi of Dubuque Hempstead, Ethan Heffel of Galena, Carter Olson of Cuba City, and Caden Gassman of Dyersville Beckman. In business news, Jeff Montgomery writes, despite strike, Deer earnings up from last year. Division that includes Dubuque facility sees operating profit rise by 38% in the fourth quarter. Deer & Company on Wednesday reported an increase in net income for the quarter and fiscal year that concluded on October 31st, capping off a strong performance despite a strike that occurred in the final weeks of its year. The company reported net income of $1.28 billion in the fourth quarter, up from $757 million for the same three-month stretch the previous year. Net income for the entirety of fiscal year 2021 was $5.96 billion, more than double the $2.75 billion recorded in the previous fiscal year. The Construction and Forestry Division, which includes John Deere Dubuque Works, saw operating profit increase by 38% to $270 million in the fourth quarter. For the full year, the company reported division profit of $1.49 billion, an increase of 152% compared to the previous fiscal year. Brent Norwood, manager of Investor Communication, said these figures represented the division's, quote, strongest financial results in over 15 years, end quote. This growth came despite a strike of Deere union workers that commenced on October 14th. The work stoppage lasted for 5 weeks, including more than 2 weeks that fell within fiscal year 2021. In a prepared statement in a company press release, CEO John May addressed the recent union strike, which was resolved November 17th. Quote, last week's ratification of a 6-year agreement with the UAW brings our highly skilled employees back to work building the finest products in our industries, he said. The agreement shows our ongoing commitment to delivering best-in-class wages and benefits, end quote. A panel of Deere leaders addressed a series of investor questions, many related to the recent strike, during a conference call Wednesday after the latest earning figures were released. During the back and forth, officials acknowledged that Deere is in the process of recovering from so-called record low inventories, but expressed optimism that a so-called production ramp-up will allow the company to grow inventory and market share in the months ahead. Deere leaders told investors that the recently ratified union agreement represented a, quote, groundbreaking contract, end quote, and they addressed how the increase in wages and benefits could influence the company's cost structure moving forward. Under the newly ratified deal, union members will receive a 10% pay increase in their first year of the contract, as well as subsequent increases of 5% in the contract's third and fifth years. The deal also included 3% lump sum payments in the second, fourth, and sixth years of the deal and provided an $8,500 ratification bonus. Officials predicted that the company's incremental costs will grow, quote, $250 to $300 million, end quote, per year as a result of the new agreement. Some increased costs, such as retirement benefits, will continue to be felt even after the six-year agreement has come to an end, they noted. But expectations for higher sales, including in the construction and forestry division, continue to drive optimism about future profits. Overall net sales for the construction and forestry division are expected to increase 10 to 15% in fiscal year 2022, with product lines across the board expected to generate higher sales activity. Quote, markets for earth-moving and compact construction equipment are expected to remain strong in fiscal year 22, said Norwood. He emphasized that multiple factors, including continued strength in the housing market and increased activity in the oil and gas sector, have contributed to that positive forecast. Keeping up with the demand could prove challenging, according to Norwood. Quote, demand for earth-moving and compact construction equipment is expected to exceed our production for the year, resulting in continued low inventory levels, he said. The forestry industry also is expected to perform well in fiscal year 2022. Quote, we expect the industry to be up about 10 to 15% as lumber production locks to remain at elevated levels throughout the year, even though lumber prices have come down from peaks in midsummer, Norwood said. Today's lifestyle section includes a holiday roundup by Megan Gloss, featuring merry events throughout the tri-state region. Highlights include Reflections in the Park, 5 to 10 p.m., Thursday, November 25th through Sunday, January 2nd. This is at Lewis Murphy Park in Dubuque. Cost is $12 at the gate and $10 in advance. Tickets are available at Dubuque Bank and Trust locations and online at Hillcrest Family Services. What to expect? The annual tradition, hosted as a fundraiser for Hillcrest Family Services, features Lewis Murphy Park lit up with an assortment of lighted displays. Another event is a Christmas walk being held in downtown Stockton, Illinois. This is 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. Friday, November 26th, with the Living Windows display at 7 p.m. and Friday, November 26th for the tree lighting ceremony and crowning of Little Jack Frost and Miss Merry Christmas. 9:45 a.m. Saturday, November 27th will be a story hour with Santa and Mrs. Claus. And 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday, November 27th, there will be horse-drawn carriage tours. This is a free event at which you can expect a Living Windows display, a tree lighting ceremony, a story hour with Santa and Mrs. Claus, horse-drawn carriage rides, and more. Local businesses hosting events or featuring special offers through Saturday. Again, this is in Stockton, Illinois. The Grand Opera House at 135 West 8th Street will perform Miracle on 34th Street at 7:30 p.m. Friday through Saturday, November 26th and 27th, and December 3rd through 4th at 2 p.m. And on Sunday at 2 p.m., November 28th and December 5th. Tickets are $15 for youth, $23 for adults. The holiday classic presented by Dubuque's Grand Opera House is based on the beloved movie of the same name. There will be a luminaria at Cable Car Square at 4:30 p.m. Saturday, November 27th at Cable Car Square in Dubuque. That's free. Cable Car Square hosts its annual kickoff to the holiday season with luminarias lit at 4:30 p.m. and Santa making his way down the Fenelon Place elevator at 6 p.m. And don't miss a lighted parade from 6 to 9 p.m. Saturday, November 27th in Bellevue at River Ridge Brewing, 303 South Riverview. This is a free event. Bellevue's Lighted Parade feature lit floats in competition for the best float and brightest float. Today's Amy Dickinson column includes this letter. Dear Amy, I am a mom with two grown children, Charlie, 26, and Liza, 23. Liza recently let me know that she and her brother were molested for many years throughout their childhood by my sister-in-law. I am terribly sad that my children thought they could not come to me and tell me this when it was happening. My heart breaks for them that they endured this alone. My daughter has been in therapy for a while now and is dealing with it. My son, however, has been using hard drugs for several years. I would like to tell him that I know what happened and offer to get him help. I am torn because this is obviously something that he does not want me to know. Should I respect his privacy or should I tell him that his sister told me? I am afraid that if I say the wrong thing, his drug use may spiral out of control again. Signed, Heartbroken Mama. Dear Heartbroken, you should be honest with your son. Please do not let his addiction control your willingness to face this heartbreaking challenge openly. You cannot control how he will respond, but I hope you will hold fast and stay in his corner. Holding on to this secret must have been excruciating for both of your children. You don't mention any consequences for the adult who abused these children. I hope your daughter will permit you to attend a session with her therapist to discuss next steps, including going to the police. Male victims of sexual violence are an underreported demographic, and your son deserves to tell his story, to be believed, and to receive help. MaleSurvivor.org is a resource dedicated to male survivors and those who love them. You and your son can be connected with other survivors and with counselors. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thanksgiving Day, Thursday, November 25th. I'm your reader, Paula Carezzi. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening.